Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, and welcome to episode, I think it's episode 6 of Bilge Pumps.
Sounds about right.
Goodness me, we have managed to go, these have gone past quickly. I'm, of course, Alex Clark, and we have Drac, aka
Hello.
Alex.
Hello.
And we have Jamie.
Howdy.
So it's all the regular crowd here, and today's topics, just so you can be properly worried about what exactly we are on, is statues, what are their value? 2, how do we remember history? 3, lessons of history, and we do have a 4th bonus topic if we manage to get through those too quickly. If not, you can, but we'll keep the bonus topic as a surprise. So, let's start off with the one who's from the nation, which is possibly having, I don't know, maybe the most, maybe the least, I'm not sure. I've certainly seen less about it in the press. Jamie, your opinion on statues?
Statues? Oh, sheesh. First up, when it comes to opinions, it's my considered opinion that opinions on the political issues are very much like assholes. Everyone has one, but no one particularly cares until they get on the nose.
Well, that's a mental image I'm going to need a few browns of rum to get rid of.
Basically saying I'm not really, I'm not really all that enthralled with, commenting on such a blatantly political subject, because that's exactly what statues are. The statues are inherently political,
yeah.
Right from inception, right till their destruction. And in my perspective, I think that the half-life of the politics attached to something like a statue is generally about 2,000 years. It's only after that that its historical and artistic value can actually be appreciated. So I think, when it comes to statues, if they last 2,000 years, then they deserve to be considered works of art and for historical value. If they don't, well, then it's just run-of-the-mill. They're working as intended. They are a political statement that's drawn a political reaction.
Yeah.
In Australia, we haven't had anywhere near the same degree of response to statues that has obviously been happening in the United States and the United Kingdom. There's been a little bit of argy-bargy about Captain Cook, but he got his comeuppance when he got shot by the, was it the Lions, Fijians, one of them, for allowing his crew to behave as they did. The oldest statue known on Earth is 40,000 years old. It's in the British Museum. It's a carving of a half lion, half man. It's an incredible piece of work. It's an amazing carving out of a mammoth tusk.
Mm.
And we can appreciate that. We can appreciate that, 40,000 years ago, a human being carved this work of art. But 40,000 years ago, that was a statement. It said something. We've got no idea now what it is, but it was not created to be a work of art. It was created to make a statement. It might have been, we belong to the Lion Man clan, or it might have been, this is our Lion Man God. We've got no idea. And that doesn't actually detract from it. It adds to its mystery. Then if you wind back some 4,500 years, you've got a similar statue made out of hippo ivory in Crete. Now, it's an incredible piece of work. It's a statue of an athlete. It's got veins appearing through its hands and toes as this athlete strains against to do the amazing feat. But it was smashed and it was burnt. And it wasn't even looted, because the precious objects that were part of the statue were found in the wrecked shrine. Now, that statue was possibly destroyed, and we can surmise on this at least, because we know a bit more about the context of it than the 40,000-year-old statue. we can surmise that it was part of the old Minoan religion before Crete was hit by the tsunamis from the eruption of Santorini. Now, of course, you know, that most of the inhabitants of Crete were pretty pissed off with their gods after that, thinking, well, actually, no, you actually look after us. You priest kings, you priest queens, you know, where were you? Why didn't you save us from this thing? Isn't this exactly the sort of thing you're supposed to be saving us from? So, yeah, political statement, statue gets smashed. Statue working as intended, just that society wasn't working in the way that the statue's makers intended. That's that's the difference. And wind forward 4,000 years, yeah, it doesn't really particularly matter in my point of view, you know, what statement that statue says. It's a statement. Yeah. And if it's got, if you're going to front up in the House of Parliament, if you're going to stick yourself up in a park in behind a face of bronze, then you have to wear public scrutiny. Yeah, that's my perspective.
I can understand that, and I can agree with that. I have to sort of, I would say possibly my half-life is a little bit shorter than yours. My half-life would probably be about 200 years. But that might, coincidentally, that may protect Nelson. I'm not sure. But,
just about, yeah.
Yeah, that might be my criteria, protecting Nelson. I'm not really bothered about most of the rest of it. I like Mel. I think it's going to sound strange. I always associate, and it is political. The statues are put up for, what are the reasons the statues are put up for? And that's what I think is how you have to judge them. Again, there was a statue brought down in Bristol. I can absolutely accept that statue needed to go. Frankly, there'd been a campaign for it to go for ages. I do think, in a nicest way, the council was dealing with it in a democratic manner. There does seem to have been a significant pushback by certain interested groups, but it was taking its time, but it was being handled in a democratic manner. So I would prefer them to wait and let it run its course democratically, but I can understand the feelings went overrun, and that was that. Although, again, in the nicest way, if it was so critical then, and people had been elected on getting rid of it, then you wonder why the council hadn't moved faster in getting rid of it.
Councils move fast? Seriously?
Yeah, that's the trouble. Technically, you know, there has been a campaign to get rid of that particular statue for about 20-odd years. But when I sort of turn around and people go, oh, yeah, Nelson wrote a letter, and I'm sort of going, well, Nelson wrote hundreds of letters and expressed all sorts of weird opinions in his time. He wasn't really good at politics and didn't really understand anything beyond his ships. You can tell that because of half the trouble he managed to get into in Naples.
Mm-hmm.
And half the troubles he gets into his career. Basically, he's very good when he's on a ship in the middle of the ocean protecting Britain, where any other time you really don't want to listen to Nelson. But that's what he dies doing at the Battle of Trafalgar, and that's kind of an important point, and that's why we have Trafalgar Square, and that's why we have him on his plinth in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Not because we venerate his political opinions. He never stood for or won an election, in my memory.
To be fair, and again, it comes back to what I was saying before about political half-lives. What about Boudicca?
Mm.
Here we have a queen of the Iceni tribe. Okay, we know nothing about her except for the Roman spin and the mythology that's been built up about her. But I'm pretty sure there's an awful lot of practices of the Iron Age cults that would all find extremely offensive.
Oh yes.
But you know, she's got that message there, and that particular message is what people have focused on and has carried her image down through the ages. I think Nelson is a good contender for being able to achieve that level of focus, I suppose. We don't particularly care about Julius Caesar's politics anymore, so we can see, but we see him as a historical figure. And he was a slave owner, of course. Again, it's to me, it's that half-life of when the politics no longer apply. And, you know, when it comes to issues such as, you know, obviously the American Civil War, well, you know, that particular set of politics has been kept alive. So therefore, well, I find it... the statues, therefore, remain a political statement.
Yeah.
You know, have the politics of Nelson been kept alive? I don't know. I'm not British. I mean, not to me as an Australian, no. So it doesn't particularly bother me. And as I said before, Captain Cook, well, he's already had his comeuppance. So I'm happy to commemorate him personally. Once again, it's only a personal opinion. I'm happy to commemorate his ability as a navigator. So
yeah. I tend to take a three-stage view with an additional qualifier. The three-stage view, I think, is a little bit more objective. The last qualifier is a bit more personal. But I tend to go, why was the statue put up? I mean, there's the kind of general, as you say, it's there to make a statement, but why was it put up in terms of kind of, was it put up by the nation for the nation, like, say, Nelson's Column, for a national level interest, or was it put up by a singular interest because of a specific thing? Maybe the person just left a bequeath in their will that said they wanted a statue of themselves, or they did a very specific thing that a very specific group decided they wanted to commemorate this very specific person for. So there's that kind of dichotomy. The second criteria would be, where was the statue put up? If it's put up in a public space, as in an actual properly public space, then at that point, if the public have to have that in their space, then I suppose there's probably a legitimate argument to be made that the public could have an interest as to whether or not it stays. But if it's put up in a private space, even if you can see it from a public space, well, I'm sorry, but if it's in a public space, you can put up whatever you flipping well want. You could put up a statue of any kind you like, and as long as it doesn't violate an actual law, the opinions of the public don't actually matter in the slightest. But there's all sorts of things that people can do on private property or can own on private property that are not allowed on public property. Even if you want to go on a complete sort of tangent, like with the stuff that I do for medieval reenactment, I can, within 8 feet of me, there's probably enough swords, halberds, pole weapons, bows and everything to equip a small army. As long as they stay on my private property, that's absolutely fine. If I carry so much as one of them out on the high street, that's it. So when you apply that to statues, it's like, yeah, if you've got a statue up on a private and a university campus is still private, it's up to them if they want to keep it or not. I don't actually genuinely care what the public think about it, because you start touching on all sorts of interesting issues about what a private individual or entity can or can't own or can or can't display within the boundaries of the law, obviously. And the last thing would be that if people want to get rid of a statue for whatever reason, is the reason that they want to get rid of it actually relevant to why the statue is there? So, as we were mentioning, the statue that got torn down in Bristol, you can probably make a legitimate argument that although the statue wasn't put up to commemorate Colston's role in the slave trade, everything that he did, the reason why he was able to give so much money to the city of Bristol and get all the accolades that got him the statue, is completely tied up with his activity in the slave trade. So there's a very strong connection there, and if people object to that, then there's a discussion to be had. But as you say, with Nelson, literally the only connection to any of the current arguments he has is he wrote a letter at one point. That has nothing to do with why the statue was put up. It has nothing to do with what he did that merited that statue being put up. So, as I say, it's like the bit that people are objecting about is entirely irrelevant to most of his career and why he's there in the first place. So that would be my third criteria. Then my personal criteria at the end of all of it is how honest and consistent are the people making the demands being? Because it's all very well to say, well, due to current political hot topic issue that is relevant today, and 6 months down the line, someone will be protesting something else. Are you being consistent in your demands, or are you going after select items just because you want to, or just because you have your own personal agenda about something? Because as you point out, like Julius Caesar owned slaves. The pharaohs of Egypt all owned slaves. Almost, and if you expand it beyond the current slavery hot topic, pretty much anybody who's had a statue put up to them who basically hasn't existed in the past 10 to 15 years probably had some kind of view that these days would be considered an incredibly political hot topic. I mean, if you really want to stick your hand in that particular fire, you could even look at things like, say, LGBT issues. Up until about 2000, it was pretty much standard to be against them. It shifted very quickly and very rapidly in this century, and now you'd be completely insane to go on TV and start denouncing them left, right, and center. But you could easily do that. You could crack jokes. You could say also whatever you wanted, pretty much on live TV in the 80s or 90s. So pretty much anyone who's died before that point, who's had a statue put up to them, will have had what today would be seen as objectionable views on that.
Yeah.
So, and again, I guess this is where I say that, you know, a statue's purpose for existence is for you to measure yourself against.
Yeah.
That's what it's put up in the first place.
Yeah. But are you measuring yourself against that person as a whole? Yeah. No. Or are you measuring them against what they're put up for?
But what wasn't important to the makers of the statue can become very important to people down the track. Mm. So, you know, and I guess, you know, obviously, the slave trader you were talking about to him, it was perfectly normal. There's nothing wrong with it. It was just another day at the office. But now that's very, very different. But obviously, I agree with you, and I made a similar point that, you know, you've got to draw the line somewhere, and everyone's going to have a different definition of that line. But I think it's fair enough to say that, okay, well, we have statues of Boudicca because she represents British nationalism before British nationalism existed. All of her, for want of a better word, barbaric traits have been put to one side and accepted. So, you're right. It is what was it for? What does it say, and how much does that contentious component play in that character's history? So, you know, clearly a Confederate general who revolted against the Union can't really wiggle out of that.
I do not know how the U.S. Army ended up naming bases after them. Seriously.
Yeah. Well,
look, for starters, they were the losing side.
You've also got it. I can understand it as a effort of conciliation.
But most of these bases and most of those statues were put up years and years after. We're talking decades after.
Yeah, World War II period. Yeah, it's. I mean, in a lot of ways, it has to come down to the fact we have to acknowledge that as humans, we're all hypocritical when it comes to this kind of stuff. It's just about. Yeah, so where do we draw the line on it, and how much are we actually willing to acknowledge that we are being hypocritical? It actually reminds me of a Simpsons episode, weirdly enough, where Sideshow Bob is running for election, and you see Homer going through, I agree with this killing Selma and Patty policy. I don't agree with this killing Bart policy, but it's two I'm in favor in, one I'm against, so I'm going to vote for him. and it's the same kind of thing. It's just like... it's like when it comes to statues and whether we want to keep them up or keep them down, ultimately it's every person who has a statue put up to them. Yeah, the statue's put up for a specific reason, but if people want to then judge the worthiness of that statue staying up on the basis of their entire life, you're going to be anyone, whoever you want to commemorate, you're going to be going through and going, well, I agree with this, but I don't agree with this, but I agree with this, but I don't agree with this. So,
yeah, and should we get rid of the Lion Man because we don't know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's a very, very strange little thing you find yourself in, to be honest.
It's part of the fascinating context of human nature. Humans are just absolutely crazy creatures. You can't understand them, but you've got to live with them.
And I find I have a sort of segue on the Nelson topic, mm-hmm. going back to, which gets us into our next topic quite nicely, because when I used to teach at King's, when I used to do that, mm-hmm. sometimes I would take the students for a wander around, I'd take them to see HMS President when she was alongside, HQS Wellington, the sloops, which were alongside in Thames, and sometimes I'd take them around the statues. And actually, I used to use the letter which is published by by the person who received it after his death, of Nelson, as an example when I was talking about Nelson, because I'd go, well, look, there's Thatcher Nelson, which is to do this. There is a letter which is published after his death, which is where he expresses pro-slavery ideas. The problem is, though, with this, and as I used to teach him, I was going, we do not know what the letter was that was sent to him. We don't have that letter. Someone might be able to, listening to this, might correct me, might go, we do have it, and I might have skipped past my research. If we do, then I apologize. But in the years I was looking at it, and when I was teaching this course, I could never find a letter which it was written to him. So I could never find the letter which Nelson is responding to, because Nelson is not just writing a letter randomly. He's writing a letter to a friend in a response to a letter that friend has sent him. And if you consider the way people tweet, etc., and writing is a standard form of communication this time, consider what people might say on the phone to their friends when they're chatting with them, or even what we sometimes say on bilge pumps when we're just chatting to each other and riffing off each other, which if you didn't hear the whole conversation and just took that one thing, could sound really quite bad.
Mm.
So this is the point, in the nicest way, history is complicated. And when we are remembering history and when we're talking about history, the trouble is we are remembering pieces of the puzzle, but we haven't got A, the full jigsaw, and B, even all the pieces of the jigsaw.
And we don't have the picture on which to copy the arrangement of those jigsaw pieces.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it's like one archaeologist I remember... he came up with a very useful phrase. He said, the past is what happened. History is our best guess at what the past actually was.
Yes. Mm. And of course, that history is very much guided by the glasses through which we look at it, whether it's beer goggles or whether it's, a microscope. It's, we can't help but look at history through the context of our own times, and it's dangerous, but it's also natural. So that's why you need people to explain the details and to put things in their context, and why ultimately I guess all these things have to come down to that terribly democratic principle of beyond reasonable doubt. Do we have a reasonable doubt that slavery was a major pillar of Horatio Nelson's life? No, obviously not. Was it a major pillar of this chap who was toppled into the river? Mm. Well, yeah, okay, we've got more than enough for that. But can we convict the Lion Man? No, we can't, because we just know absolutely nothing about him. So, it's history is fascinating. And it's also a hell of a lot of fun, isn't it? Just the classic example for me is World War II. For decades, there was this untouchable version of history that was the grand narrative of World War II, whether it's the Battle of Midway or any particular scenario. It was, so-and-so was there, he was the general, and his version was the be-all and end-all. But it's only now, after they've passed, that we can actually look at the private documentation. We can look at the records, the sequences of events. We can challenge assumptions. We can challenge, for want of a better word, propaganda, and say, well, actually, maybe this guy's account was more a matter of face saving than it was of historical fact. And, you know, there are some people call it historical revisionism. Well,
yeah,
it's maybe historical revisionism is necessary in the face of historical spin. So,
yeah,
it's been pointed out to me by a couple of YouTube historians that I've collaborated with that, yeah, if you believe a lot of the, like, if you take, for example, World War II Germany, if you believe most of the sort of I was there, I was this general, this admiral, this air marshal, etc. accounts that came out of the post-war bit, you would believe that Germany had an absolutely faultless line of decision making that should have won it the war, except for apparently Hitler stepped in at every single possible opportunity and made the wrong decision, the wrong call. He was the one who was always messing it up. And everyone accepted that for ages. And you had this idea that somehow, and when you stop to think about it, it makes no sense, because you have this idea that somehow Hitler was a clever enough and manipulative enough politician to be in charge, to get himself into a position where he's in charge of a country, but also a complete and utter moron when it came to anything military. But the military was still listening to him for some reason. And that, when you look at it that way, it doesn't actually make sense. But when you're looking at it down this very narrow view, you think, oh, well, yeah, Germany would have won except for Hitler. Now that, as you say, a lot of those people have passed on, a lot more research has been done, it's like, it's actually, oh, actually, no, most of this is actually face-saving. The person who wrote the account made a bad decision, or there just wasn't the material or tactics or the vehicles there. And they're covering for it because...
Or you didn't want the political storm of daring to speak out against the public hero at the time.
Yeah, and so, it's now. But now it's a case of where we can look at that. And at the time, obviously, Hitler is evil, so let's blame Hitler for everything. Everyone will accept that without question. But now we can look back and say, well, actually, without exonerating Hitler for anything he did, he's not actually responsible for half of the screw-ups that the German military made in World War II that have previously been attributed to him. And it's the same thing. It's going back through history, the one thing that you see more and more these days in general circles, but as we all know, is the one of the worst enemies of a historian is putting everything into a binary context where something either right or wrong. Mm. It's black or white, left, right, up, down, sideways, whatever. There's almost never a binary answer to something.
Well, if you consider the traditional... Also, to be fair, okay, Jamie, go on.
No, it's you. Your turn.
Well, if you consider the traditional perspective, this is something which I spent half my life dealing with, I swear. We always have the thing that the American and Japanese arms are the ones who are good at naval aviation, the Royal Navy's terrible at it, and that the British only win wars due to the quality of their leadership, not the actual technology or stuff they have, barring radar, which is amazing. And you sit there and go, actually, no, the British had quite a lot of good tech, and actually some of the generals and admirals were actually not as great as their marketing would suggest.
Mm.
It's sort of the traditional narrative has gone. It's like the amount of times I get told, oh, the German E-boats were amazing. Well, A, they're called Schnellboots, not E-boats, but that's just what we called them. And leaving that to one side, they really weren't. They get beaten up all the time by the British in the Channel. Yes, they have some great victories. Yes, they do win some stuff. But they're also getting smashed on a fairly regular basis.
And boarded. Look,
yes.
Look, the thing is that, you know, it's just when people are introduced to a new subject, you know, it applies to everybody. It's not just other people. The way that you take on a new subject is you categorize everything. You put them into nice, neat little boxes. And the definition of academia is to fill boxes with boxes and those boxes with more boxes. So
occasionally it's almost like to make and fill them with octagons instead of boxes just for the fun of it.
But what I'm trying to say is it's a matter of the depth of your perspective. So your first year student is obviously not going to know the granular detail of your doctorate or your master's degree. It's, and so people always sort into their minds according to patterns. And often you make things fit a pattern as opposed to it actually having that pattern. And I guess it's easy to trounce the Royal Navy's Fleet Air Arm performance because it performed in a completely different set of criteria than the Pacific. And you haven't got anything to compare it against. So therefore, yeah, you can criticize it. It's easy to do. And you can move on without actually having to challenge yourself about it. So it's, but getting back to what you're saying earlier, it's when it comes to many decisions as well, I mean, how many times in your life have you made a decision and then had to spend a while trying to figure out why you made it? I'm sure that that applies so much to history as well, that so much of our decision-making is actually retrospective to try and justify something that we've done. It's just, again, you know, we follow, whether you're a politician or a military commander or a sportswoman, you often act before you think. Because if you thought all the time, you wouldn't act. You would be second-guessing yourself constantly. And your brain basically makes a snap value judgment, weighing all your previous decisions that might apply to the scenario, weighing all your previous thought processes and saying, I reckon this is what you would choose to do. And it's only after you do it that you come back and try and justify it. And that causes all sorts of problems. And you know, it causes a great deal of self-deception. And people who sort of deep down realize that they've made a mistake will not want to admit that, and therefore start making bigger and bigger lies and, you know, claims to hide the fact, just from themselves as much as anyone else, that they made a mistake. You know, this is, again, this is human nature. I'm sure there are technical, I know there are technical terms for things I've just described to you, because many years ago I studied cognitive psychology, but I have to say that I have seen it so often, over and over and over again, in my career as a journalist and as a reporter, that people do not always make the best considered decisions because circumstances don't allow them to do so.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like when you look back at, I think the thing is, it's about context. People, they love. I hate to say this, but a lot of people are very selfish in that they love to have everything that they personally have said or done taken in full context. But they're very lazy when they make judgments about other people and other things, and refuse to look at the context, because it's the lazy, easy decision that they made to judge something one way or another fits with their preconceived biases. And an examination of the context might reveal that actually you're wrong, or you're partially wrong. And because there's a small possibility that they might be wrong, they just flat out don't want to consider it at all. I mean,
and of course, none of us have encountered that in any of our areas of hobbies either, have we?
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, I actually used to say I have quite an interesting perspective on that one, because I am dyslexic and dysgraphic. I had to accept from an early age that I had to say, yes, I'm wrong about my spelling, please correct me. And this is actually what got me into trouble and ended up getting me not allowed. Because I admitted that my spelling was occasionally wrong and all these things, and I was still, even no matter how well I learned it, occasionally I get it wrong and I have to use a computer and these things. Have had to use a computer for my schoolwork since I was 11 years old. So I've carried a computer around for every single class since 11. This is why I ended up not doing languages at GCC, because the linguistic teachers basically went, well, if you're dyslexic in English, you definitely can't do French and German. Which was completely opposite as foreign to me, because my Latin teacher I'd had since, because at the primary school I'd had a scholarship to, had had Latin from the age of 5, had been really great and had actually been one of them, along with the history teacher, had been the two people who'd been most helpful with my dyslexia. Mm. But it means that because of this experience, I'm quite good at admitting when I'm wrong when it comes to my spelling and writing. However, I must admit, when I'm fixing electrics on my model railway or things like that, usually electrics on my model railway, cars are other things I'm actually fine admitting it. But in another way, when it's wrong, it takes a lot for me to admit, I don't know what I'm doing here. Hence, you know, it got to the point with my railway, and you can find us on Twitter, that after about a week and a half of bashing my head against the brick wall, I finally admit on Twitter and ask some people on Twitter who know about train stuff, what is going wrong here? But it took me a week and a half to admit on the model railway, and that is sort of an area. Now,
because you're proud of your train set, whereas you don't have that same sense of identity with your writing.
Yeah.
So,
although writing is actually what I do for a living.
Yes, well, I suppose it's that's true. That's true. I mean, look, I don't have dyslexia anywhere near the same degree as you, but I do have it, and I will still for years I would spell separate wrong. Just and even now I have to stop and think, how do you spell it? And it would just come off my fingertips like that without me even thinking of it wrong. Another word, and you know, my profession is words. So, likewise, it's a matter of, well, okay, it's, I admit it, deal with it, move on. And it makes it so much easier to have to handle with the editing of copy editors and copy tasters when you're not so invested in your particular, piece of work that you can handle that. And I guess, and that's the thing. People invest themselves in a statue. People invest themselves in a book. People invest themselves in pictures, in quotes, in characters, TV shows. And you just can't say a bad thing out about them. You know, football teams. It's there. It's human. It's a damn pain in the ass, once again, but we have to live with it.
Yeah, and I say it comes down to how you, with sort of this second topic that we're now discussing about how we remember history. We have to look at things in context. If we looked at things outside of context, we'd just be flat out wrong about 99% of history, because it's very, very, very rare that you can ever come across a person or a situation where you can just neatly parcel them off and say they were entirely good, or they were entirely bad, or they were entirely smart, or they're entirely dumb. There's always a range. And one example that springs easily to mind would be, say, the Age of Sail. And this actually also plays into the kind of thing of actually putting not just the negatives, but the positives in their proper context. Because if you take a very simplistic view of the Age of Sail, specifically the Napoleonic Wars, you could very easily say, the reason the Royal Navy won was because the French and Spanish navies were rubbish. The reason Trafalgar was won, even though the Royal Navy was outnumbered, was just because they were rubbish. And the Royal Navy was not rubbish, therefore they won. That would be a very easy binary way of looking at history. But when you look into it, it's actually, no, there are problems with the French Navy, there are problems with the Spanish Navy. And yes, that does allow the Royal Navy to gain an advantage, but they only manage to exploit it to the degree that they do because they have a massive degree of experience and professionalism on their side. But there are still bad Royal Navy ships, bad Royal Navy captains, and there are still good French and Spanish ships and good French and Spanish captains. Recently, when I was doing the video on the Nile, you look at the French battle line, Admiral Villeneuve, well, at the time, captain or commodore, or whatever his rank was at the time, perfect example of an awful French captain, sees the vanguard and center of it, the fleet being shot to pieces by Nelson, and sits there and goes, well, that's a bit of a tragedy. I guess I might as well make my escape plans, despite the fact that he's got four or five ships of the line that might have been able to turn the tide of the battle. Conversely, two ships down the line, you've got the captain of the Tonnant, who literally nails the Tricolour to the mast and basically says, we're not giving up, and is still fighting half a day after practically everybody else has given up. And pretty much the only reason the ship ends up surrendering is because, well, it's either that or sink, and the captain's also dead from about 50 million different musket and cannonball rounds. So there's the two extremes. It's like Villeneuve is fulfilling the French stereotype for the Age of Sail, but 100 meters away is a guy who, if he was fighting a different battle but fought it in that way under the white ensign, everyone would be holding up as the paradigm of how the Royal Navy should fight. It's like he's basically doing
and
what
if the Royal Navy had lost, if the Royal Navy had lost, exactly what would have happened.
Yeah. I mean, he's basically doing what Richard Grenville did in The Revenge a couple of hundred years earlier against multiple Spanish warships. But that leads into sort of my point about how you accurately remember the positives as well as the negatives, because if you go in with this very binary view of this is bad, this is good, and you conclude in this particular example that the French Navy and the Spanish Navies were awful, you're actually denigrating the achievements of the Royal Navy, because anyone can beat a lackadaisical Navy that can't fight for toffee. A Navy that can take on and fight two or three continental navies at the same time and win when there are some decent people in there, and perhaps even when the officers aren't great, then the men actually still fight pretty well. That's a heck of a more achievement for the Royal Navy. And it's the same thing you like the and with the whole political situation surrounding 9/11, it became very fashionable for a while to say, oh, I know I keep mentioning the French, but it's very fashionable to say, oh, the French were cheese eating surrender monkeys and all of this kind of thing. And people point, oh, yeah, Waterloo, Trafalgar, Agincourt, blah, 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 all this other stuff. It's like, well, yeah, but hang on a minute. If they're such pushovers, why the heck did we spend a thousand years fighting them? And why do we not have the Angevin Empire anymore? it's like, these are the awkward questions that the minute you go below a surface level binary view, you suddenly start having to address. And that's a UK perspective, but you could quite easily do the same thing looking at a US perspective. The US propagandist perspective of the Cold War is that the Russians were always behind, the Russians were always backward, and the Russians only keep up through vast numbers of nukes pointed at everybody. But again, then it's like, well, if the Russian economy was so bad, if their technology was so awful, etc., then why Vietnam? Why were Vietnam and Korea such hard fights? Why was everyone so worried about Cuba? Why did the Cold War last until the 1990s? It doesn't make sense. Yeah. If you take a binary view, it only makes sense if you take a contextual view. And this is how we have to remember history. If we don't have a contextual view, then A, we're remembering it wrong. And B, there's that old saying, obviously, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. If we remember the wrong history, and we decide that, oh, this is how history is because our current political shallow view says this is how it must be to make ourselves feel better, then all that's going to happen is a few decades down the line, without that proper view of history, people are going to come along and exploit that gap in people's knowledge to do all sorts of weird and wonderful things that you'd really rather they didn't.
It's what you're saying is exactly right. It's George Orwell, isn't it?
Mm.
He who controls the past controls the future. He mm-hmm. who controls the present controls the past. So I guess that's the opposite end of this whole debate, isn't it? This is why it goes both ways. This is why we should be preserving these statues so that we remember them. But as has been repeatedly said, well, the United States hasn't forgotten that they beat the British because they tore down all King George's statues. So, there's much more context. There's
but they have forgotten they were beaten by the British in the 1812. It's arguable they have managed to forget the 1812.
That is true, yes. Yeah.
They do regularly forget the reason the White House is white.
Yeah, I think this is the thing. So when it comes to remembering history, you can't forget it. It happened. And no matter how much you might want to, and unless and until someone invents a time travel machine in some way to avoid the grandfather paradox, you are not going to change it. So destroying it, denying it, or coming up with a very biased binary view of it is a very, very bad idea. It's a stupid thing to do. There are parts of history that would have been acceptable. Yeah, but the thing is, there are always going to be parts of history that are objectionable to whatever is the current morality. And what is the current morality 20 years ago is different to what it's today, to what it's going to be in 10 years' time. But if people want to object to the way past generations have emphasized or de-emphasized a certain part of history, then the proper context to do that is, okay, if you no longer want to glorify this person or this particular aspect of history for whatever reason, first examine if your reasons are actually justified or whether it's just sort of blowback from a current political issue. And second, if there is a legitimate case for saying under our current understanding of things, we actually would prefer not to glorify this particular person or whatever, then the correct way of dealing with it is, okay, we will now move them into a place where we can put their actions in context and explain why this thing exists. Why did this statue get put up? So what did they do that merited this statue at the time? Why have we taken it down? And actually, at that point, you can encourage a much more nuanced and a much more contextualized view of history because you see the whole thing.
Yeah.
Several Eastern European countries have done that very well, I think, where they've taken Soviet-era brass statues and kind of melted them into the plinths of new statues. So you've got these distorted, I wish I could remember which country it was now, but I saw it a few days ago, these distorted Soviet statues under the feet of the new one. And okay, so there's part of the old Soviet statue, which no one complained about in the West at the time when they were getting torn down, I have to say. Surviving in a new context, and it's still making a statement, just not the statement that was intended when it was made. So therefore, statue working as intended, you know?
Yeah, Taiwan, which has all those statues of their first, let's pronounce their dictator, which are all gathered together in one garden, aren't they, or something? You can wander around, they're all looking at each other. And it must be the most boring garden party known to mankind.
There's another place where there's a lot of Soviet statues put in the bottom of of a bay, so you can swim among them and watch the coral growing on them.
You look at museums. I mean, museums are a perfect example of this. Museums are a perfect place to put something that you might where you might object to either the thing or what the individual did, but you can present it in a context that everyone understands. This thing's in a museum. It's here for information. It's not here to make a particular statement one way or another. I mean, you go to the British Museum, they've got these Topheth pots from Canaan. And it's like, these are the pots where they sacrifice children. There's nobody on the planet who's ever going to endorse that these days. But they are there in a glass case with a label telling you what they're there for, what they were used for. Nobody is sitting around going, the British Museum is encouraging child sacrifice. We must go and smash it all up. Because you understand this is a museum which is not making a moral value judgment on what's going on there. It's just representing history and information for you to decide in context what you think about it. And so, this is the thing. Don't destroy history. If you don't want to glorify history or a particular historical artifact, put it in a museum and explain to people why it's there.
Or at the very least, just bury it so that someone can dig it up in 1,000 years' time and appreciate it for what it is.
And be very confused and probably... Yeah, and probably conclude it was used for ritual purposes.
Yes.
Oh, God, I guess it's hard. Yeah, it's the joy of... It is the contextualization of history, which we have to remember. It's one of those things... It's also one of those things which is most difficult to try and get across when you're... And this is one of the things I think we've got an issue with. In so much of the world seems to be... And then I don't know about... You all, and of course Jane, will have a far more specific view on this than I will. The amount of focus on that is on the part of the world which is on Twitter, which can only explain itself in 280 characters or less now. It used to be 140 characters or less. And you sit there and go, A, not everyone in the world by a long way is on Twitter. So it's a self-selecting group. But also... 280 characters, even if you do start doing what's called a thread and you start having multiple tweets combined together, does not really allow a lot of space for nuance and contextualization. It doesn't. No. And it's, it's that impact on sort of the memory of history when people just put forward their point. I don't like this guy. This guy should be taken down. Why? Or I don't like, or this one, or I do like this guy and he should be preserved. And you're going, why? Both sides, you need to have the why, the context.
I was going to say, it's like if you want, the thing is, again, it's the other thing I was thinking about, any kind of protest that is calling for the suppression, destruction, removal, or whatever of anything, no one ever makes any kind of progress by simply doing that. You always, to make progress, you have to have something to replace it. It's I mean, it's the same kind of thing as we probably all know in various professional workplaces. You always hate the person who comes along and complains about problems all the time and never offers a solution. The person says, oh, this isn't working. Why isn't that working? You did this wrong. If someone comes up and says, well, that's not working, but what about if we did this? That's a lot more constructive than, oh, I just don't like you because you're this, I don't agree with this thing. And it's the same thing with it, with the, if we're going to be changing in this case, how we remember history via statues, what are we going to put up instead? Because it's going to be a very boring place, to be fair. Statues, as you said, for 40,000 years, statues have been part of human history. If we're not going to tear them all down and declare ourselves the new human species, like Homo sapiens non-statuaris or something.
40,000 years, we've also been tearing them down when they've been offensive.
Yes, but that we've always replaced them with something else.
Well, yes, that's right. And yeah, but that's obviously part of a cycle or a process. Mm. So, you know, we have to accept that these things are viscerally offensive to some people. It physically hurts, physically upsets. And naturally, that's what they're focusing on.
Oh, yeah. But
now that they're given an opportunity to express themselves, or now that the momentum is there, that's what's happening. And that, you know, and obviously the spillover around the edges as well.
Yeah, where... I mean, it's the thing. Actually, so I'm half English, half Bolivian, and I've got quite a lot of family in Bolivia. I get a lot of background into Bolivian history, and they're mostly 95%, as far as we can tell, native. Yeah, so that side of my family has had a whole wonderful few centuries being brutally oppressed by the Spanish conquistadors and everything. So when I see a statue of Francisco Pizarro, or sort of by sympathetic relation, Hernan Cortez or something like that, yeah, I have this kind of, okay, I really don't like that. But at the same time, I'm not about to go ripping it all to pieces, because I understand that other people have other reasons. If I look at it, I might go, yeah, I don't think it's suitable for the capital city of Bolivia.
You're not quite so close to it, though. You're not quite so close to it.
Try going to Spain with a Bolivian mother and you look half Bolivian. And if you think you've got racism problems in the UK, just wait till you look South American in Spain.
My heritage is Germanic Lutheran, so, and Cornish, so that's two very oppressed people.
Yes, and
speaking as someone who is half Cornish, half Scottish in my family heritage, both are equally suppressed. It's terrible.
So, yeah. but you know,
where is the Cornish brave heart?
I can afford to joke about that, because I'm well and truly removed from that point in time, and that's a physical location as well. So, you know, this is what I keep trying to say. Statues are a political beast, and they're going to reflect the politics around them just as much as they broadcast their own politics. And politics is in the eye of the beholder, and always will be. And that statue is not going to be a historical object for 2,000 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the thing. It's like, for me, it's always a case of, if you want it to be a positive movement, suggest what we're going to do instead. Like I say, if I was asked by whoever's currently president of Bolivia, they're having a bit of issues with that at the moment. Who should be replaced as that statue of Francisco Pizarro?
Well, hang on. Which countries aren't? I mean, yeah, I think Britain's been having that problem recently, and so is Australia. So,
but yeah, it's like, I wouldn't say tear down a statue of Pizarro and leave it at that. I would say tear down a statue of Pizarro, put a statue of Manco Inca in place. So there you go. We're taking away, but we're also putting back. And the same thing. It's like, okay, yeah. That statue of Colston, as you say, almost certainly needed to go. And there's probably a few other statues that on balance things probably definitely need to go. But what are we going to do instead? What are we going to put in place to show that we're not just doing something because it's negative, we're actually putting something positive in place. I mean, my personal thing would be if you want to put something on a plinth in a statue in London or Portsmouth or Bristol or something, I think Commodore Denman is well overdue for a statue, because especially in the current context of why Colston's statue has been taken down, who better to replace him than a Royal Navy captain who dedicated his life to stopping trade ships and actually ended up getting in trouble with the politicians back home because his attitude to seeing slave stations on the West African coast belonging to other nations was to go in and burn them all to the ground and set everybody free, regardless of the consequences, because he just viewed it as, well, I'm here, I represent the Royal Navy, I have some guns, and if you mess with me, I'll come back with more guns. And yes, there might be political fallout, but that's not going to matter because your slave factory is dust and ashes. That's the kind of person you definitely, especially in this context, you definitely should be commemorating, someone who went above and beyond even what the politicians wanted him to do to put it all to an end. So yeah, we can all agree that that's a person worth celebrating.
There's a different motivation for putting up a statue than there is for tearing them down. And usually it has a lot to do with celebrity of the moment. You'd probably find yourself putting up a statue to a reality TV show or the sports star of the moment instead.
And every day we do stray further from God's light.
So getting back to what I was saying before about opinions and how everyone has one, I think you should probably replace them with bird baths and cat towers.
Probably not in the same location, though.
In a nicest way, as a pro dog, no. Do not they replace them with cat towers. They have to be replaced with something which is suitable
for dogs. Fire hydrants.
Actually, according to my dog, the best thing to sniff is a nice telephone pole or lamppost. So, you know, it has to have something like that. It has to have something for the dogs. We cannot be catist. We have to be doggist as well.
And let's be fair. Statues are a perfect place for birds, just generically. Pigeons absolutely love them. I mean, what's going to happen if they take down Nelson's Column? They're going to be the pigeon problem in Trafalgar Square is just going to go exponential. They will have their vengeance if you take away their perching position.
Oh, good Lord. Caramba. Actually, no, the one I found funny was where some people actually, and I'm not sure if this is true, instead of ending up outside the... they didn't realize there was apparently some people in Hull, and I got this from a friend, so I haven't seen this on the news, and if it's wrong, it's good. I apologize, and my friend who sent me a message was completely wrong, but apparently someone mistook the William Wilberforce monument in Hull for another Nelson column because it looked similar, and they were campaigning about getting that. They had to be corrected. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that's some of the things, you know, this is what worries me sometimes about the what's going on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've done almost an hour. What number of the topics have we got up to?
Well, that I think it was part of. So our third topic was lessons of history and if we need it. Well, I think we kind of covered a lot of that, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in the broader context of that final part of that, it's like, yeah, getting away from the whole statue issue at the minute. Generally, history does have a disturbing repeating pattern, and it holds off just long enough for the bulk of the population who experienced the last time everybody messed up to die off, and then everything starts wheeling back around again. And I know obviously in the previous episodes we've talked an awful lot about the rising situation in the Far East and the South China Sea, and we don't want to keep going back over that.
Not talk about China.
We're not going to go over that. But
one of the reasons we picked today's topics was to try and avoid China, because we have felt that our listeners have been hearing so much about China. Yeah. So we were desperately looking around for topics which could allow us to avoid talking about China.
Mm-hmm. But in the wider context, the fact that we've made so many references to what happens in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. There are so many historical parallels, and it applies across the board anywhere you look, really. When there's not really a tremendous amount new when it comes to politics and military strategy, especially when it comes to things that involve a naval focus. I mean, you can look at the situation in the Black Sea with the fact that Russia wants to keep the Crimea as a port, warm water port. That's something that Russia's always been trying to do.
I will never understand, because then they have to fight Turkey and Greece to get out, and you just sort of go, in the nicest way, you're getting a warm water port, but where are you getting access to? Okay, let's say you do get past Turkey and Greece, you do manage to get past them, you're now in the Mediterranean. Your choices to get out are the Suez Canal or just straight to Gibraltar. Neither of which are a good place to go. Basically, you're going from one small chamber to a slightly larger chamber. You're not really getting anywhere with I know why they want it, because they traditionally do want it and all these things. But this part of me just said, that's just not worth it.
Well, it's kind of like it's a historical parallel, isn't it? How many nations and how many navies have chased something for ages and ages and ages, like a dog chasing a car, and then when they get it, they have absolutely no idea what they want, what they're going to do with it, because they've forgotten why they wanted it in the first place. Yeah.
It was fascinating what you were saying a moment ago about how things repeat. I remember when this happened about. There's a guy called Peter Turchin wrote in Nature magazine about 10 or 12 years ago that history repeats itself in a cycle. I can't remember what length his cycle was. It was something like 50 years. And he then went on to detail 2020. This is from about 2010. And the scary thing is, the guy actually got it right. So no one actually paid any attention to him back in 2020. And here he is now doing the whole ha-ha thing from the sidelines. So, yeah, Peter Turchin, what is he? Where's he from? Damn journalist not giving proper reputation up high. I can't see where he is, but he wrote a book, of course, at some point. And
on the history repeating itself side, there is one option coming up which does look like a potential of history repeating itself, because apparently the Chinese, as well as massing on the Indian border, are also massing on the Nepalese border. And if you want to see how Vietnam could have got so, so much worse, imagine it where the people that you're trying to occupy are Gurkhas.
There's a reason we recruited from the area instead of trying to keep control over it.
Yes.
Yes.
Let's put it this way. Britain tried with Afghanistan. With Nepal, we just recruited them.
Well, hang on. How many times did Britain try with Afghanistan?
About three times, so, I think.
Yeah, Nepal kind of just went up and went, yeah, let's not.
Yeah, you know.
This seems like a silly place to be.
In the nicest way, Britain is, let's be honest, took a long time to learn the lesson of Afghanistan. As I said, three times. But we learned pretty quickly the lesson of Nepal.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I realise the Chinese army is, like, Lada, we are now, I've broken our rule about China, so I owe a pound for the sin bin or something. But leaving that to one side, Nepal, not a good place. Do not invade. There are a lot of people with a lot of military skills sitting in a very small space.
With very nice smiles.
Yes, let's put it this way. Let's say your invasion does go and you do actually manage to successfully invade. You then have to occupy it. In the nicest way, the only scenario that will turn out good for you is if, for some reason, the Americans then decide to invade alongside you. Because then they will be equally sad. You do that. Goodbye to invading anywhere else for the next 50 years. You won't have an army left.
Yeah. But, yeah, this is the thing. It's like, you always need the lessons from history, whether it's the lessons from early 20th century politics, whether it's the lessons from late 18th century politics, whether it's the lessons from the Roman or the Greek empires, or wherever else. There's only when you look at humanity as a mass, there's only so many ways that people make decisions as a collective group, and pretty much all of them have been tried. They've even gone the whole way of humans have even gone the whole way of let's form ourselves into one gigantic army and just march across the face of the planet until somebody stops us. The Mongols tried that one. So we've been to almost every extreme of human endeavor. So the idea that somehow we're going to invent some new and much better way of managing ourselves, I think, is pretty much a pipe dream. Because almost every idea is going to be recycled, except now with the internet.
when it gets recycled almost every day.
Yeah.
And yet so many people refuse to learn it. I mean, just as a classic example, here in Australia, we had our Prime Minister say a few days ago that, the whole Black Lives Matter issue doesn't apply to Australia because we've never had slaves. Which was wrong, because we've had, maybe not the upright, knock them out, drag them here form of slavery, but we've had every other version of slavery possible as a colony and as a young nation. And it took historians to point that out in no uncertain terms.
Well, so let's be honest, penal colonies were basically white slavery, but with a nice legal judicial overtone.
Precise, very much so, yes. But we also had the whole Pacific Islanders being dragged here and, Japanese pearl divers, and you name it, we had them here, basically.
And then, of course, there's the whole, and now I'm going to feel terrible because I have forgotten the treatment of the Aborigines. And all that stuff.
But
let's not get started on what a recent mining company has done, because we will, all three of us will sit here complaining about that particular mining company for the whole day.
Anyway, but the point is that a mere matter of days later, the same Prime Minister has gone and doubled the university fees for history. Because it doesn't lead to jobs.
Oh, it does lead to awkward questions. Tell that to Google. Who hire more historians than software engineers the last couple of years, I've heard.
The humanities in Australia are now facing vastly ramped up university fees, because the government doesn't want to subsidise these useless, critical thinking types that embarrass prime ministers when they make bold assertions.
In the engineering world, this is how you get bridges falling over and thousands of people dying. The slightly disturbing thing is that if you put it that way, people actually get the point. It's like you point out, if you stop engineers from learning things because they tell you awkward things like, no, you can't have a 720 degree loop on your skyscraper because it will fall over and kill everyone in a 3 mile radius. People understand that, but with the best will in the world, even the worst engineered bridge or skyscraper is only going to have a body count that reaches 4 to 5 digits. If politicians suddenly decide they don't want to hear from historians because historians tell them awkward things they don't like, that's how you get wars, and that's how you get body counts that run significantly higher than that. Because
it's not just wars, it's civil unrest, it's authoritarianism, it's communism. It's again, you don't learn from your mistakes and you repeat them.
It's also how you get the idea that history is just for the elites to learn, because the moment you up the cost for history, it's only going to be the people who have enough money that they can go and study it. And then you start to get history being the preserve of the people who are elite. And nice this way, I would hate to point it out.
Shaped by
look,
them. Yeah.
Look at how many of those major companies, which people keep talking about, are actually run by historians. How many of the great lawyers, how many great politicians have degrees in history. Still to this day, in a nicest way, historians end up running quite a lot of the world because they are taught to critically think and they are taught these things. If you make that an elite degree where only people who have money already can learn it, you become a self-fulfilling prophecy and you create a ruling class, which will be historians. Very efficiently. You know, and let's be honest. Actually, what's wrong with this? Because I've got a PhD in such a ruling class. I would be a king. I support this. I will become a new emperor academic king.
That drawbridge up as fast as possible.
Oh yes, yes, great.
And on that note, we've gone over our hour.
Let's put it this way. Our timing usually does run to about 70 minutes. We aim for an hour and we get 70. So we're a decent movie. We'll call that. A decent movie is usually about 70 minutes. They can be longer, but yeah. Right then. So anything we want to add before we go?
Over the world, which bit of the world are you taking?
Which bit of the world would I like to take? I've always rather liked the Caribbean, but I feel really that's a bit warm for me, so I'll take Scandinavia. I have very, very pale skin. And I'm half Cornish, half Scottish. I love the heat, but it doesn't love me. It turns me quite red. So I think I've got to go for a more cooler climate. So I'll take Scandinavia, Iceland, Greenland off your hands quite happily. You know.
And you, Drac?
How about you two? Because you know,
I don't know. I'm torn between the Mediterranean, just because it's such a hodgepodge. I'd like poking it and seeing what happened. although I'm slightly better built for the climate, I couldn't stand so much vegetation based cooking. I'd probably eventually wind up either somewhere like Canada or New Zealand. Because I'd like to say Australia, but to be honest, I prefer being able to put my shoes. Yeah, I prefer to be able to put my shoes on without it being an act of faith.
I didn't want to mention that as a reason for not going for Australia.
If you're in New Zealand, it's like Australia's the big buffer zone where it's anyone who wants to come after you has to get through that first. In New Zealand, all you have to worry about is the odd earthquake. And maybe the odd surviving Haast's eagle, but that would be interesting.
I'd do what China's doing. I'd take the Tibetan plateau.
Oh, that's nice.
That way I can turn off the taps.
Oh, cruel but efficient. Cruel but efficient. It's also the reason why the Indians, in the nicest way, are going to have to react. Yes. You know, let's be honest.
That's not a nautical subject, and this is a maritime podcast.
So yeah.
Better leave it.
Right, then. So thank you very much. I think we're about 70 minutes, and thank you to our listeners, and we look forward to hearing more from you for podcast 7 or Build Trump 7. Way.
Probably actually be fun. A little bit more about shipping then.
Oh yeah, we will do. We might even get on to what was today's bonus topic, which was looking at nuclear cruisers and seeing if the US Navy had actually built the Strike Cruiser, what would have happened to the rest of the world shipping? And we were actually at one point talking about HMAS Kangaroo Punch. As a possibility of that, but we'll leave that hanging for Bilge Pump 7. Yeah. Right then. And
see you.
Bye. Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.